Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, and welcome to New Books in Astronomy. I'm Meg Rosenberg, and today I had the opportunity to speak with William Sheehan and Christopher Consolis, authors of the new book, Galactic Encounters, Our Majestic and Evolving Star System from the Big Bang to Time's End. This book was published by Springer this past September 2014, and it does three things. First, it recounts the development. Hi there, and welcome to New Books in Astronomy. I'm Meg Rosenberg, and today I had the opportunity to speak with William Sheehan and Christopher Consolis, authors of the new book, Galactic Encounters, Our Majestic and Evolving Star System from the Big Bang to Time's End. This book was published by Springer this past September 2014, and it does three things. First, it recounts the development of ideas surrounding our solar system's setting within the Milky Way and our galaxy in relation to other features visible in the night sky. The authors then connect this broad historical outlook with current scientific understanding of stellar evolution, galaxy formation, and cosmology. And finally, the chapters are always connected back to the human mind and its capacity for exploration and critical thinking. And these three things together make for a very insightful read. So without further ado, here's our conversation. I am joined today by William Sheehan and Christopher Consolis, authors of the new book, Galactic Encounters, Our Majestic and Evolving Star System from the Big Bang to Time's End. Bill Sheehan is a historian of astronomy and the author of several books on the history of solar system studies. He's also a practicing psychiatrist and astronomer, and he brings this unique perspective to his work in the history of science. Chris Consolis is a professor of astrophysics at the University of Nottingham, and his research focuses on galaxy formation and evolution. So welcome both of you to New Books in Astronomy, and I can't wait to chat about this book.
Great, thank you.
So first of all, would you mind each giving us a little overview of how you became interested in astronomy, and in particular how this collaboration, this book project, came about?
Okay, well, let me start since I'm older, and presumably a little bit longer at it historically than Chris, although perhaps not more intensely. I've been interested in astronomy since I was, just a child and grew up during the exciting period of the space program, had my own small telescope, and lived in a large metropolitan area, Minneapolis, at a time when you could still see the Milky Way from within the city limits. So it was pretty natural for me to get interested in astronomy. My first interest was really the solar system, because those were the objects that were the most accessible to my viewing. And back in the 60s, when I started out, in fact, it's been 50 years ago this year since I had my first telescope, I really became more interested in the nearby bodies of the solar system that were being explored by spacecraft. But eventually, the reason I got interested in this book was that I wrote a biography of E.E. Barnard, who was a great photographer of the Milky Way and actually a tremendous all-around, if you want to call it, astronomical athlete. I mean, he studied just about everything and had a wonderful story where he rose from poverty in Nashville around the time of the Civil War to become a great astronomer. But it was really my interest in his solar system observations that led in turn to an interest in his work on the galaxy. And that was sort of the foundation of this book from my point of view. Chris?
Right. So my story at least begins somewhat similarly in that when I was younger, I got interested in astronomy just by going to telescopes and actually getting my own telescope. And like Bill, I also looked at solar system objects and concentrated on those for quite a long time. So when I went to university, I was interested in becoming a physicist, but I got my first summer student job at the Yerkes Observatory, where actually I met Bill that summer, which was now over 20 years ago, hard to believe. And I didn't stop from then, so that really hooked me on to astronomy, but also onto the deep history of astronomy, which a lot of this book is about, which is the characters and the way that we've learned about galaxies and how we figured out how they have formed, and also how where they are, what they're made out of. And so, based on my experience of starting off as a summer undergraduate research student at Yerkes, which is an observatory in Wisconsin, which is run by the University of Chicago, where I was an undergraduate, I then went and did a PhD at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And from there, I did postdocs at the Space Telescope Science Institute and then at Caltech. And then I moved on to the faculty job in England in Nottingham, where I am now. And my interest has usually always been about galaxies. I haven't worked on many other areas, but I've also had a deep interest in the history of the field, which I think is reflected in this book as well.
Okay, thank you. So, well, getting right into the book then, the first chapter, which is called Setting the Scene, you kind of lay out this major theme of the book, which has to do with why people study the heavens. And you mention a desire to get involved and participate in the universe. Could you tell us a little more about that drive to participate?
Well, one way of starting would be to explain a little bit more the circumstances under which Chris and I met. As he said, it was at Yerkes Observatory. And one of the great astronomers associated with Yerkes Observatory during its early period was E.E. Barnard. And I happened to be down at Yerkes, both working on this Barnard book that I eventually published, but also I was there to relive an experience, an observational experience that he had had, a rare eclipse of the Saturnian satellite Iapetus was occurring when Chris happened to be out there as part of his assignment. So we were able to recapitulate this very famous observation by Barnard that revealed a great deal of useful information for that time about the rings of Saturn. So the first chapter of the book includes some vignettes of attempts to use modern technology, CCD imaging, to look at nebulae and galaxies from a small observatory that I set up about 50 miles from where I am right now. And in contrast to the Yerkes Observatory, which of course still boasts the largest refracting telescope of the of its time, and it remains so today because everyone has built reflectors since. But I had a small telescope out there, a Ritchie Chrétien 10-inch telescope that I hooked up with the help of a friend with a CCD imaging instrument, and we went to town on all of the deep sky objects from there because we still have a dark sky. So it really pulls you in to be present under the sky and experiencing them firsthand, as opposed to, you know, simply downloading images from the Hubble Space Telescope or watching, you know, simulations or things like that. So that's really the point of the first chapter, is to just convey to people that the universe is out there to be had for the asking, and they don't need to, you know, have all of this filtered through the eyes of, quote, experts or authors, that they can go and see for themselves. And really, I hope that this book does that. It encourages people to go out and look and appreciate and experience this wonderful, marvelous universe.
Yes, and astronomy in particular has this very developed tradition of amateur astronomers and professionals. You know, there's a very strong collaboration between those two groups of people that goes back for ages. I wonder, is that how you got into amateur astronomy? I mean, obviously you're a little bit better equipped than many amateur astronomers with an observatory, but how did that all come about?
Well, I think initially it wasn't necessarily to make those kinds of contributions that you're talking about, and that still remains the purview of a limited number of people that are either well equipped or extremely motivated and specialize on certain observational programs that require perseverance as much as perhaps anything else. But you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the lures of astronomy is that, of course, it's the oldest science, and the stars have always been of interest. They've marked the seasons. I think that astronomy proper really began with the earliest agricultural settlements, because it was then important, as it hadn't been to hunter nomads, to be able to predict what the seasons would bring in terms of harvests and so on. But you're absolutely right also in terms of the contribution that amateurs have made to this field, because until the 19th century and maybe the end of the 18th century, William Herschel, we'll speak about him a little bit later, astronomers, professional astronomers at observatories were mainly interested in practical matters. You know, they were interested in timekeeping, determination of longitude, spent a lot of their time fixing positions with telescopes that really weren't concerned with the physical properties of the objects, but just their positions. So it was only in the 19th century that a number of well-to-do people who were able to afford the equipment and had the leisure to devote to these kinds of studies were able to take off in whatever direction they chose and study things like the nebulae, which really were beyond the reach of the professional astronomers at the time. And so you're right. Absolutely. Amateur astronomers have contributed immensely to the legacy of astronomy that we've inherited today.
So in chapter two, we kind of get right into the historical aspects with catchpole of the nebulae, which catchpole is not a word that I had come across before, but the title refers to Charles Messier and his father's profession. Would you mind explaining that a little bit?
Well, catch poles were people that were essentially employed as tax collectors in pre-revolutionary France. And that was the way that Charles Messier's father made his living. And so I thought it was an interesting, perhaps metaphorical, takeoff on that to describe the son, who was really interested mostly in tracking down comets. There was a great deal of glory to be won in those days for discovering comets. And he only cataloged the nebulae. And his list, the Messier objects, include many of the most interesting objects and significant objects in the night sky, as we now know. But he really was only casually interested in them for what they were in themselves, and was mainly interested in them because it made his job of tracking down comets easier to know what objects might be mistaken for comets existed in various parts of the sky. So King Louis the 15th actually called him the ferret of comets, and that was his great contemporary claim to fame. But of course, now he's totally remembered because of his nebulae, the Messier objects, rather than for his comets.
Could you maybe explain at that time, or when the first fuzzy objects were coming to people's attention, what were they in people's minds, or how were they viewed that early?
Chris, do you want to answer that?
Yeah, sure. So when they first saw the nebulae, they thought that first of all, they knew it wasn't comets because it didn't move, so they knew it was stationary like the stars, more or less. But there was debates about whether or not they were actually external galaxies. That was one idea that has been around since the 18th century, although it took over 100 years to prove that. But also that they were more distant star clusters or gas nebula. And as the book later on shows, the ideas between these three different things would come and go until it was realized that actually the nebula are all three of those things. And it took spectroscopy and deep imaging to confirm distances to actually find that out. But they didn't know, basically. But they did. The Herschels later on were the first to really talk about this in detail, and they thought that they were perhaps one of those things. It depends on, you know, who you talk to and what time in their career. I think people did change their mind on what those nebula were.
Mm-hmm. So, well, speaking of the Herschels, they are introduced in the next chapter, chapter 3, which is called I Have Looked Farther. And we meet William Herschel and his sister, Caroline. And what struck me, well, one of the things that struck me about this chapter was that so much of William Herschel's life had to do with balancing astronomy and music and finding patrons to support him. And a lot of his discoveries leading up to the discovery of the planet Uranus, all of that happens before he really gets into his studies of the fuzzy objects. Could you tell us a little bit about what life was like for the Herschels, or how, what were his circumstances coming to astronomy when he had all of these other interests as well?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, William Herschel is one of the most inspiring and, intriguing figures in the history of astronomy. I mean, as you pointed out, his original career was as a musician, and he came from Hanover, which at the time was just being united with Great Britain, because the Georges, the kings of England after the Glorious Reformation and all that sort of, or Glorious Restoration or whatever it was called, were the kings of England. And so there were a lot of people that came from Hanover, including Handel, the composer, and others, because the German court was at Windsor at that point. And William Herschel had spent some time as a musician in the Hanoverian Guard, sort of a bandsman, and came under fire during the Seven Years' War and decided that maybe it was healthier to take his professional interest elsewhere from the front lines, ended up in England. And like a lot of immigrants, he had tremendous energy, a desire to make some sort of a mark, and wonderful dexterity with musical instruments. And I think that in many ways, the training that he had in music, both in terms of using instruments, which requires tremendous manual dexterity, but also in reading scores and thinking musically, which is very mathematical, contributed to his ability to transition into astronomy. And he eventually did that. He started out really as a great builder of telescopes. And we talked a little earlier about the contribution of amateurs. And in part, William Herschel's success was that he had confidence of himself in himself and developed independently, where people that knew more than he did weren't around to discourage him from trying. And so he built his own telescopes using really pretty much self-created technology for grinding and polishing mirrors. And before he became well-known, he'd actually put together telescopes that were superior to any telescopes that were being used, for instance, at the Royal Observatory of Greenwich or other professional institutions. And he was able, because of the optical quality of these telescopes, to use high magnifications. And while he was doing this and surveying the sky, he was really interested initially in finding double stars. Double stars really require a different type of technology than just positional astronomy, like, you know, determining the positions of stars for a star catalog. You really have to blow them up in order to separate them, because some of them are very close together. And that's what he was doing when he discovered Uranus. He was using high magnification, and he noted that the sixth magnitude star in the constellation Gemini was a small disk rather than a stellar-like point. And he was probably the only astronomer that was carrying out an observational program that could have made that recognition. So that occurred March 13, 1781, and really that was his entree into the wider world of international astronomy.
Yeah, so there's a description of some pretty horrific injuries that happened in the line of duty here, being an astronomer, including one with Caroline Herschel and being caught in the machinery a little bit of the domes. In any case, maybe you could describe what was the relationship between William and his sister Caroline like?
Well, the relationship really was partly a reflection of the fact that in the 18th century, and you get a sense of that from reading Jane Austen, for instance, you know, there really were very limited options for women. And at least in Hanover, Caroline had older sisters, was expected to just basically stay at home, help her mother as a menial. She did a lot of sewing, domestic kinds of work, and yet she had a powerful mind. She was interested in music. She had a good enough voice to later become a professional singer under William's tutelage. But there really were no options open for a woman like her. And women at the time, young women, weren't sent to school. One of the handicaps that Caroline had throughout her life was that she never even learned to do basic arithmetical calculations. So she had to carry a multiplication table with her wherever she went. And so when William got established in England and started to work as a professional musician, first a brother named Alexander came over, who was a very skilled machinist. And then as soon as possible, William brought Caroline over too, because he empathized with her plight and really wanted to help her get underway on her career as well. But she really became his all-around helper, completely self-sacrificing, although not without the occasional willingness to complain. Her diary is full of complaints and grousing, but it's understandable. And just a tremendously hardworking person that completely submerged her identity in the work of her brother.
So chapter 4 actually continues the story of the Herschels a little bit. We see them a little bit later in life. And we introduce this question that Herschel has about whether the cloudy stars, whether if you could just see better and better, would they be resolvable into stars? Or are they really some kind of diffuse matter?
Right. Yeah. So that was one of the central questions, because you weren't able to resolve them into stars. And in fact, that didn't happen until much later, into the 20th century, actually, except for supernova, a nova and that kind of thing. So, Herschel knew right away that if he could identify stars in these objects, then they must obviously be external star systems, because they'd be too faint to be in our own galaxy. But the debate was whether or not there was external galaxies at that time, because the prevailing wisdom back then and up to the 20th century was that our own galaxy was all there was in the universe. And so it was a major question. And he didn't have the technology, unfortunately. I'm sure he would have done well if he did have it, but he didn't have the technology to tell the difference. He didn't even have spectroscopy yet, which came later on, which did help with the problem a little bit, but didn't solve it for quite some time, even when it was available. But he certainly knew that he could figure it out if he could resolve stars within the nebula, but he wasn't able to do it because he just didn't have the technology to do so.
Mm-hmm.
I never got the final answer, basically. It's the summary. He died not knowing.
But we also meet his son, John Herschel, who takes up some of the problems of that his father was dealing with, although he's called in the book a reluctant heir because he went in a different direction first in his early life. But he also was a better artist in some sense, I think, than his father was. And this sort of just prompted a question for me, but what does drawing have to do with astronomy?
Well, first of all, just to expand a little bit on what Chris just said about William Herschel, one has to keep in mind that a lot of the nebulae that were known were a hodgepodge of things. They weren't all one class of objects. So there were some nebulae that, like globular clusters, where higher magnification did reveal that these were starry systems, and others, the true galaxies, as we now call them, were so remote that they still remain, you know, just sort of cloud-like, even in William Herschel's telescopes. It was a little bit difficult to determine what exactly these things were. And then there were other objects that seemed to be gaseous in nature. And the best example of that is the Orion Nebula. So when William Herschel more or less retired the field to his son, one of the questions really was, if these are cloudy objects at relatively close distances as opposed to external galaxies, then they should change over time. We should be able to see them shifting in their structure. And so one of the questions in John Herschel's time and later was really the question of whether these nebulae, and Orion Nebula, because it's the largest and most impressive on view, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, was sort of the, piece de resistance. And really, the drawing came in because in order to determine whether changes took place, you had to have very careful and meticulous representations of these objects so that you could compare a drawing, say, made by John Herschel with one made later on, for instance, by George Bond or other people that attempted this very exacting task. And in contrast to planets where you are, limited within a very clear disk and the features are fairly contrasty, nebulae are extremely difficult to draw, as anyone has tried has recognized. So it was a long, kind of an interesting question whether the changes were just due to the limits of the artist's skill or whether they really were changes that were taking place in the nebulae. So that's kind of how the drawing comes in. And you're right, actually, Meg, that William Herschel, despite his multi-talented approach to everything, was a terrible draftsman. And John was actually a very good artist. And so really any drawings of the nebulae prior to John Herschel can pretty much be discounted as far as that goes.
Mm-hmm. Going back a little to Chris, you mentioned the technology just not quite being there for William Herschel. But he built this large 40-foot telescope, which in the book you refer to it kind of as a giant failure in a sense, because it wasn't as flexible as the smaller telescope that he had been using before, and it didn't serve quite the same purpose. But it did inspire, I think, going into the next chapter 5, which is called Of Leviathan Spirals and Fire Mists, where we meet William Parsons, the 3rd Earl of Ross, and he built himself a gigantic telescope, inspired, I think, in part by the 40-foot telescope of Herschel. Could you describe Ross's Leviathan for us?
Sure. It was a large telescope. So at the time, it was the largest in the world. And in fact, it didn't really become exceeded in its aperture size until 20th century by more modern telescopes. It was not as easy to use as the more modern telescopes, and they didn't have the same kind of instrumentation. Of course, it didn't even have photography, really. Maybe at the very end they did, but they did most of it by drawing with hand from visual estimates by looking in the eyepiece. But it was the largest mirror telescope ever built at that time, and so he was able to use it to look at what we now know as galaxies. But back then were still known as nebula, and he was able to find that a lot of them had spiral structures, which today we know is a major component of galaxies in the nearby universe, including our own galaxy, the Milky Way, which is a spiral galaxy. And so he was able to see that spiral structure for the first time, and that got a lot of people excited about what was going on. And in fact, it didn't really help the problem very much, though, in trying to figure out what these were, because people started theorizing that actually what you're seeing is not an external galaxy like our own galaxy, but was actually perhaps a solar system in formation, that these spiral arms that you can see in the drawings in the book and even in the photography that we have today, although it's obviously much better with the photograph, but you can still get the idea that perhaps, some people would think that this is some kind of collapsing gas which is going to form into a planet. And what you're seeing is not, in fact, a external galaxy, but actually a star system where you're seeing actual the planets being formed.
Mm-hmm. And there's also a point made in this chapter, which underlies a lot of the book as well, I think, which is you have to sort of look at these achievements without the perspective of our current knowledge about these things and think about it from the point of view of not knowing yet of the differences between the distances between all of these things. Is it difficult to think now as an astronomer today, is it difficult to sort of project backwards and imagine what they would have been seeing in the context of their own understanding of the universe at the time?
Yeah, I think it is. It's actually quite difficult. I've tried to do it a few times, but it's hard because they had no context at all for understanding these observations, and it was completely new. It's just, you know, the analogy would be looking at things, you know, like at different wavelengths today, you know, maybe a burst of energy at some wavelength that you see in gamma rays, and you just have no idea what it is. And there's stuff like the gamma ray burst, which is more recent. We know what those are now, but back a couple of decades ago, we didn't. Things like that, I think, are analogous to this, and that it's a new phenomenon. We just don't know what they are and many ideas for what they could be. But beyond that, it's hard to imagine, yeah, that the context of astronomy back then was very different from today. Advanced quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned spectroscopy being, you know, an added tool for the field, and that sort of comes in chapter 6 called The Various Twine of Light. And in addition to spectroscopy, this idea of the Doppler shift as well. Could you describe what each of these discoveries kind of mean for astronomy, for looking at stars?
Well, spectroscopy was a huge advance in astronomy. It changed the field completely. Basically, you can't really overstate it. It basically makes astrophysics what it is today. Without it, we would be very far behind in our knowledge. And so it's only maybe about 200 years old, roughly, the field of spectroscopy. And especially for astronomy, it's a little bit younger, maybe 150 or so, maybe a bit older. But it's still, you know, not a very old subject. But basically, it allowed us to, first of all, start looking at what was in objects in the universe, so looking at stars, looking at nebula, and then later on looking at galaxies and other objects as well, through emission lines, through different elements which emit energy at certain wavelengths, things like the famous H-alpha line from hydrogen, but every element has its own unique lines which you can identify, and then you can tell what is in that object. So that told us about abundances of different metals, of different gases, which are going on in stars. But also it can tell you about things like the temperature of the gas, of gases. It can tell you about the density of gases. And it just goes on and on. You can tell almost everything about what's going on in distant objects by looking at their spectra. But they also have what's called the Doppler effect, which occurs when an object is moving relative to another object. The spectrum is shifted. And in astronomy, we talk about, for galaxies, the redshift a lot. And this has to do with galaxies, which, because they're expanding, the universe is expanding, galaxies appear to be receding away from us. And so all of their light is being redshifted. And stars have redshifts and blue shifts, depending on if they're moving towards us or away from us. And by looking at a spectrum of a star or galaxy or nebula or whatever, you can identify well-known lines by their morphology. That is just how the lines look and how the relative distance from each other, so you know which line it is. And if you measure its wavelength of that line, and you know what the wavelength of that line is in the laboratory on Earth here, then you know how much it's shifted by, and that gives you a very precise measurement of how fast that object is moving away or towards us along our line of sight. That is the direction that we're looking. Now, the perpendicular motion is harder to measure, and that can be done in different ways, but the Doppler effect tells us how fast something is moving directly to or away from us. And it was critical in the discovery of galaxies.
Mm-hmm. And this is also the chapter where we sort of mentioned this idea of grand amateurs and their contributions to astronomical discoveries. But moving on to chapter 7, we actually get to photography, which is another innovation that you mentioned, changing the way that astronomy works in the field. And we get back to E.E. Barnard, actually. So can you describe maybe the puzzle that he was trying to describe, especially you spend a lot of time in this chapter talking about his photographs of the Milky Way, which are outstanding, and he sees these dark patches, which are very familiar. I think anyone who's seen a picture of the Milky Way will see these dark tunnel kinds of things. And can you describe maybe the puzzle he was trying to solve with these, which has to do with whether they're holes or material.
Yeah, just to, before I frame that, just to point out, yeah, absolutely everything that we really know about galaxies beyond the realms of speculation were based on spectroscopy, as Chris pointed out, which really is the basis of our understanding of the distances of them, and photography. And it was really photography that allowed us to move beyond seeing these things as Lord Rosse and his assistants did, still as, fuzzy objects, although they had some structure, to really seeing them as star systems. And E. E. Barnard, he really started out as a photographer. He was more or less an orphaned kid in Nashville, and was able to get on as an assistant at the age of 9 at a photograph gallery in Nashville and learned the trade of photography at the same time that he became interested in astronomy. And that's an interesting story in itself. But anyway, he was really trained in this new technology that was becoming available just at the time when astronomy most needed it. And one has to realize that when he started out in the 1860s, I mean, that was the era of Matthew Brady type photography of, Lincoln and the Civil War. And it really was only in the 1880s when they went from these very slow wet process plates where, you'd actually have to use neck stiffeners and things like that. Nobody could ever smile in a picture because of the long exposures to the dry plates, which were much faster. And for the first time, even though the length of the exposures was often hours, one was able to register star fields to faintness that was beyond what the eye could see. And when E. E. Barnard became recognized, again, like Charles Messier, for his discovery of comets and was invited to go out to California and join the staff of the Lick Observatory, one of the first things he did was he had a portrait lens that was bought very inexpensively to photograph an eclipse, and he tried to do photography of the deeper sky with this. And that was the first time that anyone had really seen just how magnificent the Milky Way is. I mean, one has hints of that from a really dark sky with all of these tortuous, beast-like, dark cooluses that outline the structure of the lens-shaped galaxy. But it was really there that he made the contribution of showing the Milky Way in wide-angle photographs. And you're absolutely right. There were these dark objects that appeared to be, to earlier astronomers like John Herschel, to be tunnels or tubes that were going through the starry system. And it took a long time for E.E. Barnard to convince himself, because he was, as an amateur that became a professional, he was very conservative and he was afraid to, rock the boat too much because of his humility, I think, about what he allowed himself to speculate about. But eventually he did realize that these were indeed opaque clouds that were projected against the more distant stars, dark nebulae. And he drew up a list of these, which are still used today. And that was the first evidence that astronomers had of the existence of interstellar dust in the galaxy. And of course, interstellar dust is now an active area of research and has tremendous consequences. Chris could probably address more than I, but about formation of stars, the evolution of stars and galaxies in terms of the interaction between radiation and this dust that exists and throughout ubiquitously in the universe.
In Chapter 8, moving on a little bit, it focuses on the development of classification schemes for stars, and from SETI to then the work at the Harvard Observatory with Wilhelmina Fleming and Annie Jump Cannon under E.C. Pickering there. And I guess my question is how could you explain a bit about how classifying stars sort of helps astronomers figure out how they work or how they form and evolve?
Well, I can start up in my other role as a psychiatrist. The classification system that we've used in psychiatry has been appallingly unhelpful and subject to constant controversy and skepticism. So to be able to classify any natural phenomenon in a way that really reveals the underlying laws or principles that organize that body of knowledge is essential. And, you know, it just turns out that the various schemes that were adopted, and they evolved over time as astronomers got better spectra and, you know, saw more of these objects and put them into classes. It turned out to really be a useful classification that was related ultimately to the physical nature of these stars. The main aspects being temperature and the mass and luminosity of these stars, which became sort of the underpinnings of the, you know, sort of the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram of stellar evolution. But without these classifications, none of this understanding would have been possible. And so these early pioneers, many of them women who were working at Harvard under E.C. Pickering, made extremely valiant and persevering efforts to take this utter chaos that was revealed by this spectroscope and put order into it so that other astronomers were able to boil it down into the underlying physical principles of stars.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot going on in this chapter. You describe beginnings of understanding hydrogen and helium in the sun and the fusion process. And also, as you mentioned, the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram and stellar evolution in general. So we won't be able to get into all of the details of everything in this chapter, but it sort of describes the basis of our understanding of stellar evolution over time. But in chapter 9, which is called The Nebula is Leaving the Solar System, sort of introduce this controversy over this particular kind of features, the spiral nebulae, and what they are, and are they inside the Milky Way or are they not? Could you maybe set the scene for us there about, you know, what are the opposing points of view and what lines of evidence help to determine one or the other?
Right. So around 1920 or so, this is when this debate came to a head, really. And there were two camps. One of them was that the nebula, it's called the spiral nebula, but the nebula in general, were in the galaxy. And the other idea was that they were external galaxies. And the idea that they were in our galaxy had a lot of powerful people behind that idea, including Shapley, who was the person who really showed where our sun was in the solar, or our sun was in the galaxy, showed that it wasn't at the center. This is, again, around 1914 or so. And he also calculated that the galaxy, based on globular cluster distributions, and he assumed that globular clusters, which are clusters you can resolve, which he made the assumption that they basically are going to be organized around the center of our galaxy, which is more or less true. And he did, I mean, using this, he calculated that the size of the galaxy, the Milky Way, was actually quite large, was enormous. And based on that, and based on the fact that some other astronomers found that the spiral patterns in the nebula were actually rotating, that they actually saw proper motion. So this is the motion where you see stuff moving along the sky. And so several astronomers thought they had seen that the pattern of rotation was actually changing. And that would only happen if those spiral nebula were close by. We now think that those measurements, well, we know the measurements were wrong. We don't know why, at least it's not generally accepted why they were wrong. But we now know that they were not correct. But anyway, people did believe them, and they thought that because you see this rotation happening, that the objects must be close by. Otherwise, you wouldn't see it happening. If they were external galaxies, they would be too far away, and any motion happening in the spiral pattern would be too small to be measurable. But anyway, people were measuring it, and so there was a large debate about this. And people had also found things like exploding stars, the famous supernova, I think 1882, and the Andromeda Galaxy, which was part of this debate as well. But people didn't know about supernova back then. They thought it was a normal nova, perhaps, although there were people who thought that it was a special kind of a supernova, that is a very bright nova, which would make the galaxy far away. So you had evidence, but what to believe and what not to believe was not clear, and people took sides, and it wasn't really resolved until you had, of course, Hubble, which I'm sure we'll get to in a moment, who was able to make the definite observations of this. But you had conflicting evidence. Some of it was wrong. Some of it was misinterpreted. And there was no clear-cut answer. But the astronomical community was certainly divided about this issue for quite a number of decades.
Moving on, I guess we'll get to Edwin Hubble in Chapter 11. But first in Chapter 10, which is called The Galactocentric Revolution, we kind of talk about Harlow Shapley a little bit more and Mount Wilson. And I wonder if you could explain what do you mean by the galactocentric revolution?
Right. So for a very, very long time, people thought that the sun was the center of the galaxy, that, or at least it was close to the center of the galaxy. And the various maps that people make of the galaxy for a long time, even including Herschel, more or less put the sun at the center because of what we talked about before about the dust. And dust makes it very difficult to see far away in our own galaxy because we're living in the plane of the galaxy. So we're looking right through its center. And so you're looking through lots of dust, and that means you can't see distant stars very well. In fact, most of the bright stars you see in the night sky by eye are essentially quite close, and relatively speaking, in terms of the size of our own galaxy. And so really it was Slipher Shapley who took the next step and, as I said before, used the globular cluster distances to figure out where our sun laid. And he found that the globular clusters, and the way he figured out their distances was through the Cepheid variables. And these are variables which have a pattern of going bright and going faint. And the time period between being bright and then faint and then being bright again correlates with how the intrinsic brightness of the stars. And this was discovered by I think it was
Henrietta Swan Leavitt.
Leavitt, who discovered at Harvard Observatory this pattern in the Magellanic Clouds, using data from actually taken at in the Southern Hemisphere in the Harvard Station in South America. And she discovered this relationship, and then Shapley used it to find distances to the globular clusters in our own galaxy. And he did that by using the 60-inch telescope at Mount Wilson, which was the most powerful telescope by far when it was built in the early 1910s. And he used that to take lots of images of these globular clusters. He found these Cepheid variables. He calculated how long it took for them to get bright and then faint. And then from that, he used the relationship discovered from the LMC to discover how far away those globular clusters were. And he found that they basically clustered around the constellation of Sagittarius, which is out now where we know is the center of the Milky Way. And based on that, he just did a geometrical calculation to show how far away the sun was from the center of the galaxy. And his value was more or less what we think it is today, with some corrections, but basically in the general picture, he got it right by doing that. So that was the revolution.
Mm-hmm. And along in this chapter, and we see this development of these larger and larger telescopes, and George Ellery Hale, of course, is a big figure in getting the, at first he's at Yerkes, and then he gets the observatory established on Mount Wilson with the 60-inch telescope. And then that kind of continues into the next chapter, which is called From Olympus, where we meet Edwin Hubble, who's using the 100-inch telescope, which is the next big project up at Mount Wilson. And he uses it to confirm that we say that the spirals are outside of the galaxy, that they are island universes outside. But what I wanted to ask you about was his tuning fork diagram, which he kind of lays out the classification of nebulae and galaxies. And he had these words attached to it, meaning that kind of maybe implied some sort of evolution from one shape to the next.
Yes, indeed, that is true. So his idea was that galaxies evolve along the sequence. And this has to do with theories of James Jeans, who was a British astronomer at Cambridge, who had a theoretical idea for how the galaxies would form and evolve. And so Hubble's diagram was perhaps influenced by this, perhaps more than it should have been. although he doesn't explicitly state this, I think, in his papers, more or less, believe that it's thought that this did have quite an influence on his ideas of how galaxies would have formed a center and then formed spiral arms later on. Today we know that's not necessarily true, although actually that does happen, we think, but it is not the only galactic evolution route that we know of, and in fact it might be just one of several. And so he wasn't necessarily wrong, he was just limited in his ideas for how galaxies could form. Now today we think the Hubble sequence is more or less okay for nearby galaxies, but when you go to distant galaxies, you find that almost no galaxies can fall into the classification scheme of the tuning fork, and other schemes are necessary, and actually is a very active area of research now, in fact something I work on, which is how to classify distant galaxies and how to use their structures and morphologies to figure out how they're evolving and forming.
Mm-hmm. In chapter 12, we meet W.W. Morgan, and we describe the discovery of the spiral arms of the Milky Way. Could you explain maybe a little bit about how the different regions, so there's these different sort of pattern recognition of regions that sort of led him to this discovery that there are two arms that are, and one of them's pretty close to the sun, and that made the geometry a little difficult to recognize. But what are these regions, and how would they form a pattern that could be recognized leading to this spiral arm theory?
Morgan was sort of an interesting person from the standpoint that he really was more of an artist in astronomy. You know, that we certainly have seen that there were musicians like William Herschel, and, you know, I think the correlation between music and mathematics is well established. But there haven't been that many people that were really artistic in their approach. And one of the things that Morgan specialized in really was pattern recognition. So he started out with star classifications and pointed out, because at the time there were some fairly complicated schemes that were being used to classify stars, especially by the group at Mount Wilson that relied a lot on physical measurements and so forth. And Morgan's scheme, and by contrast, really was based on the pattern recognition abilities of human beings. So as with Annie Jump Cannon and other people that had done that sort of work, a person can train themselves to be able to classify stars in a real hurry, and without much effort if one trains oneself to the task. And that was essentially what Morgan's earlier work was involved with. And that was at Yerkes Observatory, where he spent his whole life. Well, Morgan got very interested, as anyone would that does stellar classification, in some of the brighter stars in the universe, so-called OB stars. These are very massive young stars that are very luminous. And in contrast to earlier people that had tried to figure out the structure of the galaxy just by sort of doing statistical analysis of lots and lots of stars, Morgan realized that those analyses were bound to be flawed because the stars would have migrated a long ways from where they had originally formed, and any kind of underlying structure would be dispersed. So he focused specifically on the OB stars. And as he continued to work on them during the 1940s, he also realized that these OB stars form groups and that they were associated with H2 regions, in other words, interstellar hydrogen gas, and also they were associated with dark matter, these dust planes that are apparent in the spiral arms of galaxies. And so what's really kind of fascinating is that he made a discovery that's quite rare, and that is kind of a Eureka-type discovery where suddenly a pattern recognition flashes into place, and he recorded in his notebooks that he was walking from his office at Yerkes Observatory to his house, which was about 100 meters or less from the observatory, looking up at the stars. It was in the fall of the year, and the stars of Perseus were arrayed above his head, and suddenly it flashed into place that a number of the groups of stars that he had been studying were all at the same distance away. And so it was that night that he really discovered the Perseus arm of the Milky Way, and later published, as you mentioned, maps that showed the nearer spiral arms. And that was before radio astronomers or anyone else had achieved this. And even though it sounds a little bit mundane today, it really was an achievement at the time, because astronomers had been searching for this evidence of internal structure in our own galaxy for generations, and hadn't really definitively reached that conclusion. And so it was really kind of an amazing discovery that Morgan made. And he really was an interesting anomaly among astronomers.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned this, I don't want to say rivalry necessarily, but there's a relationship between optical and radio astronomy. And I wonder, the astronomers at the time see it as a competition in a way between these two methods?
I don't think they necessarily saw it much as a competition. They were each using their methods to sort of go in different directions. I think the sad thing is that, you know, the radio astronomers who were mapping the galaxy seemed to have much more definitive results because they were able to map this H21 signal across the galaxy. So they published maps that seemed to show the spiral arm structure even on the other side of the galactic nucleus. And it later turns out that their initial maps were quite flawed because there were a lot of proper motions. In other words, independent movements of these clouds of gas that they were mapping. So their maps are really pretty imprecise, whereas Morgan's maps, although they were only of the nearer spiral arms, were spot on, much more clearly delineated and detailed. So the sad thing is that everyone was so excited about the radio maps that Morgan's work really sort of fell a bit into the historical dustbin. And I think it's only in recent years that people have appreciated just what a tremendous breakthrough it was that he achieved.
Moving along to chapter 13, which is called To Forge a Galaxy, you make the point that at one point galaxies are sort of treated as point masses. They help to understand the rate of expansion of the universe and how they are moving apart from each other. But then after being treated as point masses, we can now start to consider their actual structure. And you list two major theories going on right now for galaxy formation that have to do with either a quick collapse or maybe more of a nurture approach where galaxies are interacting with each other gravitationally. Would you mind elaborating on that a little bit for us?
Right. So yeah, that's basically a good summary of the ideas that are present within how galaxies form. And in summary, basically the idea is that you see galaxies in today's universe, and did they form very rapidly, very, you know, quickly after the universe formed, within a few, maybe 100 million years, or did they form gradually over billions of years? So we know the universe is about 13.7 billion years now. So when did the galaxies form? Was it all very quickly happening in the early universe, or did it happen over time? And the way it happens over time can be several different things. One of them, it can be having mergers with other galaxies of similar mass to the galaxies themselves, and that's what we call a major merger. And then you can have minor mergers, which are tiny galaxies falling into bigger galaxies. But in each case, you change the galaxy structure, you change its star formation rate, you can change the central black hole in the center, you can change its mass, of course, because you add more mass, obviously, when you merge. Another idea is that you have gas falling into the galaxy from the intergalactic medium, that is the medium between galaxies, is full of gas. And we know it's there, we can see it, and we know that some of it does fall onto galaxies, but how much of that contributes to the galaxy's formation, we don't know. Some ideas are that it contributes quite a bit to the formation of the galaxies, and other people would think that it's not very important. So this is still a debated issue. Now, the other issue is how much of galaxies form very rapidly through a collapse of gas. That is, you just have a big, you can imagine a big spherical-type ball of gas in the early universe, and it just condenses and collapses to form the galaxy very rapidly. And that was actually the original idea for how galaxies form for quite a long time. And there's a famous paper about this written in the 1960s, which has very influential even today, about how galaxy formation happens. And that idea stayed around until the 1980s, when you started having theories about cold dark matter and how dark matter is distributed in the universe, and how that naturally gives you the idea that galaxies are forming hierarchically. That is, they're forming from merging with other galaxies to get bigger and bigger through time. But we know that some galaxies do form some of their mass very rapidly in the early universe. And again, we're talking about a time period which we cannot yet even observe, but that we know happens within a few hundred million years of the Big Bang, that some mass of galaxies must form from what you call initial collapse. But what fraction of the mass in galaxies forms that way is still being investigated and is still highly debated about how much mass actually formed in that initial collapse. But I would say that, you know, a good estimate probably is something like maybe up to 5-10% of all the mass in galaxies today was formed in this initial collapse, and all the rest of the mass was formed later on as time goes on.
Mm-hmm. And just in the interest of time, I'll just mention that it's the chapters 14 and 15 sort of go on and talk a lot more about dark matter and the origin of the universe, and then also dark energy. But just to move along, I wanted to talk about the last chapter in the book, which is called Afterglows. And you close out the book by connecting all of this history of galactic studies back to the human brain and back to what it means to explore. And I just wanted to know, why did you decide to conclude the book with a chapter that goes back to this idea?
Well, I think that one of the reasons for writing the book is really to show that the knowledge that we have about the galaxies, and of course the galaxies in some ways are remote and vast beyond our human comprehension, but really it's a book about the way that human beings, insignificant in some respects on this tiny little mote of dust that is circling the sun, one of, you know, many, many stars in the galaxy and so on, you know, how we've come to acquire this knowledge. It's a human story. And, you know, we've talked a lot in passing about the various instruments that have been used in astronomy, you know, from early telescopes to the spectroscopes to, nowadays instruments aboard the Hubble Space Telescope and so on. But we sometimes forget that the ultimate scientific instrument is the human brain, and it's the one on which the whole chain of inference and deduction either rises or falls. So, and the other thing is, you know, I mean, my background is as a psychiatrist, and I spent a lot of time studying the brain and perception and the way that, you know, people come to the conclusions that they do from what they look at and see. So it intrigued me that if you look at a microscopic cross-section of brain matter, in some ways, the way that the neurons are displayed or distributed is similar to the way that stars are distributed in the spiral arms of the galaxy. And it turns out that there are about the same number of neurons in the brain as there are stars in the Milky Way galaxy, and in turn, the same order of magnitude as galaxies in the universe. So it's an intriguing interlocking structure. And of course, we're bound to ask when we look out into the starry night sky and contemplate these kinds of things, you know, are there other brains out there somewhere that have formed that are capable of asking the same kinds of questions that we are? And what is ultimately our place in the universe? And that's, at least from my point of view, a good way to end a book like this, which is really part of an ongoing adventure.
Well, thank you for that. Just one last question for both of you, which is, what are you working on now? What's exciting for you at the moment?
Right. So I'm working on some new projects with the Hubble Space Telescope and some ground-based telescope projects. And so I'm not writing a book at the moment, but I hope to get back to doing something similar like this in the future. But right now, my research is what I'm concentrating on. It's mainly looking at even more distant galaxies than what we have already, with a new project called the Frontier Fields with the Hubble Space Telescope, which is lensing background galaxies. Lensing means magnifying with giant lenses, giant gravitational lenses from galaxy clusters, which magnify background galaxies through general relativity.
And Bill?
Well, right now I'm looking forward to an exciting year. 2015 is going to be the 100th anniversary of the calculations that Percival Lowell did that led to the search for what he called Planet X. And that, of course, the closest thing to the planet that he was seeking turned out to be Pluto. And also in July of next year, actually on the 50th anniversary of the Mariner 4 flyby of Mars, we're going to have New Horizons reach Pluto. And I've been quite involved in that whole project, both at Lowell Observatory in terms of commemorating the significance of the work done on Pluto there, including the discovery, and also with the New Horizons team. And so I'm working on a book with Dale Cruikshank at NASA Ames, who's one of the leading investigators of the outer solar system, on Pluto. So that's kind of got me tied up at the moment. And then after that, I'm going to be working with Jim Bell, who's the Curiosity rover's photographer-in-chief, on a book on Mars. So back to the solar system for me.
Mm-hmm. It's exciting. We'll look forward to that. Well, thank you so much for joining us. The book is called Galactic Encounters, Our Majestic and Evolving Star System, From the Big Bang to Time's End. And this has been William Sheehan and Christopher Consolese. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining me and having this conversation today.
Thank you.
A pleasure.
You've been listening to New Books in Astronomy. I'm your host, Meg Rosenberg. Thank you so much for joining us, and I hope to see you next time.